Hi, thanks very much. Welcome to the Lowy Institute. My name is Richard McGregor. I'd first like to acknowledge that we're on Gadigal land and I pay tribute to the elders past, present and emerging. Tonight's subject is Hong Kong. You don't need a long introduction on this from me. Hong Kong is a city that used to be kind of derided as the Great Mall of China. Beijing has always talked about Hong Kong as a commercial city, not a political city. But it's fair to say, I think, in recent years that Hong Kong has been upending all these stereotypes. We had the Umbrella Revolution in 1914, and now much bigger protests which have been triggered by the proposed extradition law. On top of that is the Hong Kong economy, which is dominated by a small group of tycoons and the issue of high property prices. So I think, you know, you could say that ordinary Hong Kong citizens have been squeezed financially, squeezed spatially, because most of them live in tiny homes, and more recently squeezed politically because of the fight that they're having with Beijing. So we've got three panellists here. On my far left, Ben Bland, a former Financial Times correspondent in Hong Kong. The author, I should say, he wants me to say this, the author of this book about Hong Kong, which is on sale outside and now at the Lowy Institute covering Southeast Asia and Hong Kong. Dr. Leihard Chan from the University of Technology in Sydney, who specialises in China's international relations and used to work for the Hong Kong government. And Jared Fu, a university student in Sydney and a democracy activist. Now, first of all, let's start with you, Ben. To just bring us up to date, in a few short weeks, how did we get to where we are now, and why hasn't there been a political circuit breaker? Why has it got so out of hand?
Well, in Hong Kong, we've seen 10 or more consecutive weekends of either huge mass protests or sometimes violent clashes between pro-democracy protesters and police, triads, criminal gangs beating up ordinary people on the metro, police beating people up. Last night we had Hong Kong airport shut down and pro-democracy activists detaining a couple of people from the mainland and then the police pushing into the airport, rescuing those people, more clashes. So there's been images of violence, clashes, huge protests on the TV screen. So this seems like something new, but actually the roots of what we're looking at are much deeper. So the proximate cause of the current protests was this extradition bill, which would for the first time have allowed people in Hong Kong, Hong Kongers, but also Australians, anyone visiting Hong Kong, anyone living there, to be extradited from Hong Kong into mainland China, which has a separate legal system. Of course, the rule of law is at the heart of Hong Kong's success and identity. China's justice system is capricious, repressive, controlled by the Communist Party. So this extradition bill basically was hitting at one of the key firewalls separating Hong Kong and making it different from mainland China. So that was the spark for this movement. But actually, there are much deeper causes, I think, of people's discontent that we can see going back to the Umbrella Movement in 2014 and even earlier protest movements in Hong Kong. So basically, there's the economic factor, which you mentioned, Richard. Hong Kong has the highest property prices in the world, high inequality, graduate salaries haven't really increased for over 20 years. More importantly, I think there's the political factor. So Hong Kong is living in the shadow of mainland China during a period of increased repression, increased ideological control, and many Hong Kongers feel their freedoms and autonomy, as well as their physical space, is increasingly being squeezed. And for me, I think the thing that binds all these things together and has made people's reactions so strong, so visceral, is the sense that it's not just their economic opportunities that are being squeezed and their political freedom, but their very identity as Hong Kongers. And I think it's probably something that Jared can address better than me as a Hong Konger. But I think it's this combination of the political, the economic, and the identity that's under threat. And the extradition bill sort of symbolized all that, and people are reacting very strongly against it.
Thanks. So we'll come back to that identity issue. Dr. Chan, this is a big moment for China as well. Hong Kong is not as important to the Chinese economy as it was in 1997, but still it's an important entry point into China. It's important for capital markets and the like. It's important for finance, managerial skills and the like. But what is the mainland's view of Hong Kong at the moment? And also, what is their political calculation as they look at this mess and debate amongst themselves whether they should, dare I say it, intervene.
Yes, sure, thank you. I think Beijing's perspective, Hong Kong's issue is completely a domestic issue, first of all. So that is the central authority or the supreme of the central authority, because you're looking at the same thing as the South China Sea issue. Beijing thing, they don't invite any other country, but it's domestic politics. So other country, they shouldn't intervene. And within the central government, they have the authority to decide what they need to do. And so what Hong Kong need to do to, you know, just follow the central government's policy. So this kind of the lie, we can basically confirm, or the first media from the Hong Kong and the highest administrative agent in relation to Hong Kong and Macau's affairs in late of July, they say that the protest right now is basically cross the red line of the one country, two system. So from their perspective, it's like one country is much, much bigger than the two system, or basically cover everything. So that is the thing that also linked with that, because of this, the supreme of the central authority, and the Beijing government will not make any concession at all. So the calculation here right now is like they try to selectively to, you know, looking at the sea issue, the conflict from the protester, and then try to frame the issue as a cultural revolution. So you think about the cultural revolution in the early 20th century, like in Ukraine, Georgia. I just finished 3 hours talking in the school at the university and talking about conservatism. So my brain right now is halfly conservatism, and now going back to Hong Kong, the situation. Just give me a few minutes to, you know, clear my mind. So the color revolution in different country, so they identify, they try to frame that because they want to bring that as the external intervention from particular, you know, those hostile, another great power, the US. And so remember the color revolution here is like, if we remember that, is like mainly from those are pro-democracy politicians or political party, they against the pro-Russian regime, and then try to bring down the regime as well. And eventually they did that in different countries. And so here China is really quite, when they frame that, so they bring that the Hong Kong's protest is trying to bring down the regime. So that is completely not the nature of the protest, because you see the protests are basically related to the extradition bill, nothing related to the regime in Beijing, I mean the central authority. And so when they framed it as a color revolution, they used the word, we need to bring it up to a strategic angle to looking at the issue. So here the key word is strategic. So strategic means like it's no longer a local issue within the, you know, the Hong Kong's area. Strategic means that you are bringing up to the national level that related to other foreign country, particularly the U.S., and whether U.S. had intervened, used Hong Kong as a pawn to manipulate Beijing's at the international level.
But having said that, I mean, okay, it's an internal affair, it's a color revolution manipulated by evil foreigners, but very briefly, China still, you think that China at the moment won't intervene?
I think it's less likely to use the intervention. It depends on how to define intervention. If you say, like right now, the news talking about whether or not the PRA will intervene into Hong Kong, this lie, I think, is less likely. The reason is, if you pay attention, by end of June, in June, when the protests already start, the commander of the PRA in Hong Kong, he met with the defense counterpart in US and directly told them, no, we are not going to intervene. So they just like make sure that don't worry, we're not going to intervene. And the intervention, the cause for Beijing is too much, for Xi Jinping in particular, is too much. And so I don't think it will happen. But on the other hand, another definition about the intervention is already happening, like the intervention giving pressure to the Hong Kong government, as well as giving pressure to the Hong Kong police as well. I think they both are under mounting pressure, have to deal with the issue, have to finish the protest and get things done as soon as possible. And so right now, if you're looking at the news, everything it seems like happening very, very quick. And the police and the level of their force is getting escalating every day. And they even, you know, just let the triers to walk away without, you know, without any arrest them or prosecute them, etc. So that kind of have the tear gas indoor in the subway. So this is not a good sign. But that shows that the Hong Kong police are under mounting pressure, and they have to stop these protests as soon as possible.
Okay, Jared. You're a student in Sydney. You've helped organise some events in Sydney in support of the Hong Kong protesters. Some of the people on the streets are your contemporaries. Give us your perspective and hopefully their perspective along with it.
Okay. Before I answer that question, could I further emphasise how some Chinese state media have accused my fellow organisers or me myself of Western conspiracy of organizing these events to bring a color revolution, say that I'm paid. But if that were true, how do I explain all the student loan that I have?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think we're going to pay your train fare here tonight. You don't worry, but you don't have to knock down. That's a bit of a straw man for us. So, what is this about from your perspective?
So, in my perspective, obviously, at the start, this whole movement was about having a full withdrawal of this extradition bill amendment, because people at the end of the day are really skeptical whether if China, its legal system, could provide fair trials and humanitarian treatment of suspects if they were to be extradited. And slowly, when the Carrie Lam administration used very hard tactics towards protesters, and just to remind everybody, before the clashes or escalation of violence happened, on two occasions, Hong Kongers came out peacefully and had a rally, and there were 1 million people and subsequently 2 million people who came out, but still, the government, Carrie Lam, she even sneakily released a press statement late at night to say, oh, I've heard all your voices, 1 million, 2 million, but we're still going to go ahead with it. And that's when on the 12th of June, which was one of the most pivotal turning points of the movement, where people decided, no, we need to step out again and have to use more direct action means. And then they were met with harsh oppression and repression by the police. And that's where everybody decided, now the movement has slowly evolved from anti-extradition bill amendment into a genuine calls for genuine democracy and universal suffrage, which Hong Kongers could not achieve back in 2014, I would say.
So is that, I mean, how it's almost certain that Beijing won't meet that demand. What does that mean for the protest movement?
Well, it certainly means a very unfortunate situation, I would say, because many people, hundreds, 700-800 people have been arrested, thousands have been injured, several have even committed suicide to plead for democracy. And with Carrie Lam's continued ignorance, and obviously it's suspected, it's an order from the Beijing government, I would say that this means a worse turn, an even more worse turn of events on both sides, especially on the protesters' side, because as you've mentioned, as Professor Chan has mentioned, there's an escalation of force, particularly on the police's side, shooting tear gas directly on face level. And just this Sunday, 4 days ago, there was a female protester or first aider. It's yet to be confirmed what her identity was, but she has now lost her right eye because she was shot in the face with a beanbag shot. And some might say, oh, if the protesters may have used violent means, then does this justify the police using this sort of force? I would say no, because the police have strict guidelines on what to do with lethal force. And in international law, you cannot use that kind of force directly on someone's head, because it could be irreversible, and it could even lead to death.
Okay. Might come back to the violence issue. Ben, I want to come back to you. Jared talked about it, the turning points in mid-June and the like. Have we missed the chance for a political settlement or a political circuit breaker? There's been a lot of proposals doing the rounds. For example, Carrie Lam, the chief executive, being forced to resign, an agreement to have an independent inquiry into police action and the like. What happened to the chances of some sort of attempt at compromise and muddling through?
Well, I think I'll make 2 points there. One is almost optimistic, but not really, and the other one is very pessimistic. So not a very happy picture, I'm afraid. So on the almost optimistic front, there's been survey data done by political scientists at the Chinese University of Hong Kong who've been out at many of the protesters talking to people to get evidence for what they actually want. Lots of commentators and other people are saying what Hong Kongers want, what the protesters want. Well, these guys have gone and asked them. And two kind of clear demands have emerged that most of the protesters agree about. And one is the full withdrawal of the extradition bill, and the second is accountability for police violence. And we know that some people who are close to the Hong Kong government have gone to Carrie Lam and to Beijing's agents and operatives and officials and said, look, do these two things. It's not going to solve everything, but it will dissipate the protests. We can move forward. And it's been made very clear up till now by Carrie Lam and others that that is not going to happen. There will be no concessions. So therefore, that off-ramp, which I think in the short to medium term might cool tensions, looks like it's out of reach. Now, I think the much bigger and more pessimistic problem, in a way, is that Hong Kong is this unique political science experiment in the world. Can you sustain a free city, mostly free city, that upholds liberal values and is supposedly moving towards democracy within the world's biggest dictatorship, at a time when not only is it the world's biggest dictatorship, it's getting more powerful and centralizing more power and driving a massive campaign of centralizing and ideological rectitude and everything else. I mean, so that just looks totally unsustainable. And I think even if we go back to 1997 and the handover, at that time it was a bit more optimistic. But actually, I think it was hard to imagine the system lasting as long as it did. So I think that's a miracle in some senses. But looking out, it's hard to see how you can sustain freedom without elections. How can you have a free society without a legitimate government? It's a really difficult problem. So for that reason, unfortunately, I'm optimistic about the long-term outlook. And because of the lack of any obvious off-ramps that both sides would sort of agree to walk back down, I'm pretty pessimistic about the short-term outlook. The one thing I'd briefly say is it is heartening to see young people in Hong Kong and others who care about their city. There's this stereotype about Hong Kongers, young and old, that they only care about money, get a good job, buy a home. But we've seen people who are making huge sacrifices across all classes of society to try and make their city better and to defend freedom and democracy, values that are much derided in other countries in the rest of the world where people talk about defending them but aren't willing to risk much. So I think that is heartening. And there has, as well as the violence, been a lot of humor in the protests, a lot of creativity that we've seen. So let's not get too depressed. I think it's pretty amazing to see people fighting for something they believe in.
Dr. Chan, I want to ask you about one point Ben made there. There's not just young people protesting. We've had the members of the financial community, civil servants. We've had members of the legal fraternity, lawyers marching in the street as well. We've even had Cathay Pacific pilots coming out in favour of the demonstrations. I was saying to you earlier, the level of political consciousness of a Cathay political pilot is about level to the political consciousness of a Qantas pilot. So I've been, you know, pretty surprised to see that. So is it a broad-based movement or is it narrower than that?
I think it's a completely like the legitimate movement or protest or request from Hong Kong's majority of the population. You see, a lot of civil servants, they're also coming up and support the protester. And you're looking at the original demand, what caused this protest is basically the protester, they are asking for five different demands. So all of these five demands is just mainly like related to the extradition bill. And then later, you know, you need to set up an independent commission to investigate the situation because you're looking at why you arrest the protester or charge them. But on the other hand, the police, they are doing a lot of violence thing and let the child go away, walk away, and then you do nothing. So all the protester requesting is just like, you know, you set up the independent commission to investigate, completely withdraw the extradition bill. So right now, the extradition bill is already like, say, oh, dead, but why not just completely withdraw it? So there's not a hard thing for the Hong Kong government to do. And what they are trying to, the protesters are trying to, is trying to uphold their liberal value, their civic values. What kind of civic value is like the freedom of speech, autonomy, or the independent judicial system? Those things, Hong Kong already have been have been holding it for a long time. And people, I'm sure Jerry, will be growing up with this kind of value as well. And so what they're asking is to keep the things they already have, not taking them away. So this is not a very, you know, difficult, you know, request or not a hard request. And that's also why, you know, all the different kinds of sectors or industries and even civil servants, they support the protester. They ask the government, please listen to the citizen, what they're talking about, what they want, the government to do.
Mm-hmm. On another topic, Jared, the issue of identity. Beijing says, you know, Hong Kong is part of China, but they, you know, Hong Kong people are also Chinese, part of the Chinese family. But in Hong Kong, there's a strong sense of being quite separate. Could you tell us about that?
So, by your question, you raised two areas. One is about Hong Kong being a part of China, the other is about the Chinese identity. And I would like to point out regarding Hong Kong being a part of China, there are two pieces of information that I would like to point out is that during the 1970s, I believe it's 1975, China, the PRC, I would say more correctly, in the United Nations, they actually took out Hong Kong and Macau from the list of self-determination, of colonial places that are allowed to have the right to self-determination. That's one thing. So that means Hong Kongers, since the mid-1970s, they already lost the right to decide whether to continue as a British overseas territory or to be independent or to be a part of China. They already lost that opportunity. And secondly, during the 80s, when the Sino-British talks were beginning, and also, mind you, these talks, Hong Kongers were not directly involved. It was only talks between
the British and the Chinese.
Yeah. And moreover, is during this time, there were multiple surveys that were asked through Hong Kong citizens back then how they view Hong Kong being handed over to China. And actually, if I remember correctly, the statistics show that it was only a 5% of the population who supported being returned to China. 70% wanted to stay as a British territory. And I believe there were like 15% who even wanted to be a territory that is managed by the United Nations. And so these incidents that I pointed out, it shows that Hong Kongers Obviously, it's hard to talk about the past because now...
So do people in China, you know, China has been the sovereign since 1997. Do people feel Chinese, or more part of the PRC, I should say, or less?
To speak anecdotally, me myself being born after the handover, the transfer of sovereignty, and being raised during this period, me and my peers, and some of my peers not even being born in Hong Kong, but we still feel a detachment from the Chinese identity. And I believe a strong part being played is regarding culture and values, because as Professor Chan mentioned, throughout the British colonial period, there were instances obviously where the British did not do good things and they didn't install democracy, or at least not a full democracy. That is true. However, the British did leave a system of law, a rule of law, of common law, and Hong Kongers back then till now have been raised in an environment where they believed that we could handle things systematically or we could progress slowly, but that is not true after 1997. So you could see why a lot of people, they would resort to, especially younger people, would resort to having an own identity, is because they have lost trust with the Chinese identity. Because the Chinese...
it's become accentuated.
Yes, the Chinese identity obviously has a very close connection with the government, because... Why I would say so is because we see a very strong nationalistic rhetoric being pushed by the Chinese government, and they use this rhetoric against different places in China, such as Xinjiang, Tibet, which are controversial. And this rhetoric pushes, it diminishes the local culture and identity of these places, even if they do not want to seek independence. So you could see why Hong Kongers, they're trying to hold tight into our cultures and values as a kind of defense against China's creeping authoritarianism.
Okay. Ben, if you want to say something, I want to go say something about that quickly, both of you, if you like.
Yeah, I just want to say, on the question of identity, I think one of the great tragedies of this whole situation is that Beijing, the Chinese Communist Party, never found a way to really incorporate that Hong Kong identity. So instead, it's now being counterposed. And I think one of the big drivers of the sense of separateness has been the pressure on Hong Kongers' freedoms and autonomy. But we see the same pattern elsewhere in China, where the central authorities find it really hard to genuinely recognize separateness within the unitary Chinese state. And I think it's really interesting that Jared was talking about history, because quite a few young Hong Kongers have been going back to the archives in the UK to rewrite their history, to write their own history. And if you look elsewhere around the world at other nationalist movements, this is a classic early step of people writing their own story as a people. And as I said, it's fascinating to me, but it's also worrying in the sense that China sees that as separatism, which is anathema to the party state and requires the strongest opposition. But we know also the more they push, the more they're driving this separate sense of identity. So there's a really strong vicious circle effect.
Also related to the identities questions. So if you're looking at the current survey quite recently, you see the number of the population, particularly under 30 years old, from 18 to 29 years old, right now, over 75% of them, they identify themselves as Hong Kongers or Hong Kongese. They don't think they are Chinese. So that kind of the identity is basically that gap, the number increased a lot. If you're looking at across Hong Kong, all of the university, they have the 8 university union, student union. In the past 2 years, the student unions declare that they are no longer, because you know Hong Kong every year at the June 4 event, right before, around that time, the few days, lots of organizations, they will organize those candlelight vigil to commemorate the June 4, the Tiananmen massacre over there 30 years ago. And since two years ago, the student unions across all of the university in Hong Kong, they already say we're not going to participate in that candlelight vigil. Why? So we have to ask the question why. So the question, the answer is not because they are pro-Beijing, they don't want to memorize. That's the things they did. But the reason is they think their identity is they only care about Hong Kong. They don't really care about much about the democratic movement or the democracy development inside China. That's what I say earlier. They don't really want to change the regime. It is them versus Hong Kong. We are we versus them. So that is the gap between, you know, the Hong Kong people, the Hong Kong, the new generation under 30 years old, and the, you know, the Beijing, from the Beijing perspective. So it's very difficult to resolve this issue. That's the ideational, completely like different.
Ben, this is about a lot more than Hong Kong. It's about China's place in the world, but it's also very importantly about Taiwan. A version of one country, two systems was meant to be the model of reunification with Taiwan. That model looks shattered at the moment. Can you talk us through about why this is important for Taiwan and what that means?
Yeah, well, one country, two systems was in fact originally designed for the reunification, I would say unification, not necessarily re, but unification, neutrally, with Taiwan. And Hong Kong was meant to be the case study. You know, Hong Kong will go so well that the Taiwanese people will jump at the chance to join formally China and give up their de facto independent government. And obviously, it's turned out to be exactly the opposite. So Hong Kong, in many ways, has been the worst possible example because it showed the total incompatibility of Leninism, Marxism, as practiced by the Chinese Communist Party under Xi Jinping, with the liberal values and partially liberal democratic system that Hong Kongers have and want to keep. So I think even in the last couple of months, as the pressures have increased on Hong Kong, we've seen this protest movement, it's actually, there's been a direct impact into Taiwan where there's presidential and parliamentary elections coming up in January. So we've seen even some of the more pro-China candidates in Taiwan having to formally dismiss the idea of one country, two systems under pressure because Taiwanese have a free media, many travel to Hong Kong, they have friends and family there, they can see what's going on. So they've had to distance themselves slightly from their more pro-Chinese sentiments they expressed previously because of the bad example of what's going on in Hong Kong. So I think there is an effect, but I wouldn't overstate it because I think Taiwan's elections, there's a lot of domestic issues, economic issues, domestic politics. And we know from survey data in Taiwan, they've also had an increasingly separate Taiwanese identity, especially for young people. There's actually a very similar trend, but by and large...
Similar to Hong Kong, in fact, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. So I think there are plenty of domestic reasons why they have their own concerns about China, but it's certainly not a good advert to Taiwan and not a good advert to the rest of the world because Hong Kong was also meant to be China's global showcase to the world. And instead, it's sort of showing some of the rougher, nastier edges. And also, as I said, just the political incompatibility. I think for a long time, we've all wanted to believe that our systems and the Chinese systems could find a way to coexist, maybe uneasy. And I think Hong Kong shows us that that's going to be very, very difficult indeed, because when liberal values and Leninism, Marxism in a sort of reassertive way come up against each other, they almost have to kill each other, and we know where the power is in Hong Kong.
Right, well, that's very uplifting at the end there.
Yeah.
Jared, I want to ask you a question about violence. There's no doubt
another
we've...
happy topic.
Yeah, there's no doubt we've had... There's been a lot of excessive police violence. We've had triad violence. There's no doubt about that. But there's also been some violence on the protesters' side, maybe initially at the LegCo demonstration a few weeks ago, but also this week at the airport, where we had an ugly incident of a Chinese journalist from the Global Times detained there in extreme circumstances. What's your response to that? Is this parts of the protest movement getting out of control? Is it just one element? Was it a mistake? What happened, do you think?
I would say the many incidents since June, all the violence shown and practiced, exercised by the police and triad members, it has definitely left a kind of hate and frustration amongst protesters, especially considering the treatment of protesters is hugely different compared to triad members, or not even triad members, sometimes counter-protesters that support the police or support the government, but they use equal means of violence, I would say. And particularly yesterday, two days ago, in the airport, I think it's also important to point out that when that Chinese reporter, when protesters went through his belongings, they found a T-shirt which was worn by, not in the Yuen-Long Triad incidents, but a couple days, 1 or 2 weeks ago in Chunwan, where there was another Triad attack, where one protester, his right arm and his leg was chopped by a machete, and the people who conducted such acts, they wore the exact same shirt, which was light blue, and it says, "I love police." So
I think
to put in that...
A picture of him in the group of the
as well.
People wearing the blue T-shirts, right, who were also photographed on the street with metal bars.
Yes. So if you put these things in context, I would say the protesters then and there, when they found out his identity, not only being a Chinese report, a reporter of the Chinese state media, and even having such close connections with the Triads who physically chopped protesters, I think that explains why, at the heat of the moment, protesters would be really upset and tied him up. And it's also important to point out that, yes, they did tie him up, but I'm not trying to say that violence is right, but I would say in comparison with the violence exhibited through, I would even say, like a government-sanctioned Triad attacks compared to the protesters' frustration is completely two levels.
Dr. Chan?
Oh, just a little bit, yeah. So I basically agree with Jared's opinion about this protest and violence. So if you're looking at from a whole spectrum, if the spectrum is like that, if you're looking at the whole picture, basically, we need to appreciate all of this, like the protester, how calm they are, how trying to be peaceful when they are doing, you know, protesting against the government. So certainly those like some cases, if you're looking at narrow it down, the violence that did happen, but on both sides, it's not just the protester, it's the police that side as well. So the protesters, some of them, they really feel this is kind of like unjust. Why we need to, you know, why the police not protecting us, but against us? So that is the anger for among some of the people, maybe small amount of people, and that create that kind of the violence happen as well. But when we're looking at the picture, we are not trying to looking at the, you know, the story from the Chinese media to focusing, narrow it down into a specific area and magnify the situation. But what we are trying to do is start looking at the whole picture. If you are going to like have the most of the protests, are basically most of them are peaceful. You know, people in Hong Kong, from the people I know, they ask people just like calm down. We're protesting. You're looking at the picture at the airport, people saying sorry for the, you know, all of the tourists, for all of the inconvenience and we caused.
Might be apologising to that Australian businessman who some of you might have seen on YouTube yesterday complaining to the protesters. So, Ben, very quickly before we go to the audience questions, there's been sort of two memes for this event in Hong Kong. Jackie Chan is one star, who's Jackie Chan, of course, is rather well known for his being pro-Beijing views. But the protesters have also adopted Bruce Lee and his Be Like Water. And they've been incredibly creative in how they've managed their protests. Can you just give us a few examples of their creativity and how they've managed to keep the authorities off balance?
Yeah, well, I think this was a direct response to what happened with the Umbrella Revolution in 2014, and people occupied the streets, and they eventually realised that sitting in one place and making yourself a very obvious target for the police and everyone else wasn't a good idea. So things have been much more mobile and fast-moving. Friends of mine who are still working as journalists in Hong Kong are pretty tired because they have to be in 10 places at once on any night as the protests move from blocking the main tunnel that connects Hong Kong Island to Kowloon, to going and besieging a police station, to going somewhere else, to push back against some triads who are beating people up. So I think, yeah, people have been very mobile. They've learned some of the lessons of Occupy. And I think the other interesting thing to me is...
cover their faces, right?
Yeah, cover their faces, because now there's... in Hong Kong, it's everywhere. There's cameras. The police are filming everything, trying to get information on who's who and trying to find out identity so they can arrest people. I mean, in Hong Kong, basically, if the police determine there's a riot and you're shown to have been there, you can face up to 10 years in jail. So these are really serious charges. But I think the interesting thing for me is how a lot of people, including middle class people, people who don't like violence, are willing to work with those who are using it. And I think people who support democracy, about 55 to 60% of Hong Kongers, they understand that you need different approaches. There's this great expression, which is climbing mountain together, but making your own effort. So people know you need the guys at the front in the hard hats and the sticks to push back against the police, so the others who don't want to confront the police are willing to come behind them. And those guys need to know that then there are first aiders to help those who get hit, and they need to know there are journalists there who are willing to be tear gassed to document this all. Because imagine how much more violence from the authorities there would be if we hadn't had really brave and committed Hong Kong journalists and foreign journalists videoing and live streaming everything. So I think it needs all these different groups of people, and that's like any social movement anywhere in the world, especially when you're against up against such a formidable opponent. It does need all these different approaches, and it's not pretty, it's not nice. You can't just go, oh, look, they're great protesters, they pick up recycling, they're heroes, they're so smart, and then the next day condemn them for pushing over the line. This is really hard, this is real, and people are fighting for something that matters. So it's going to be really messy, it's escalating, and it's quite scary. But amidst that, there has been a lot of creativity and people showing it, they're really committed to fighting for their future.
Okay, so we'll go to audience questions, and can I say questions, not statements, please?
Thank you, it's John Connor. I have not seen any commentary at all on as to the effect of the events in Hong Kong on Shenzhen, which after all is just across the border, has almost the same size population as Hong Kong, and thousands of people going back and forward every day. It's a very busy and open, in many ways open border. Is there any evidence as to whether this has stirred any sentiment across the border in Shenzhen, or is that something that the Chinese have managed to keep sealed?
I think it's been pretty hermetically sealed. I mean, you can go across the border, but it's actually not easy. People have to produce their identity cards. And we know that what's happened in the last few weeks is that when Hong Kongers are crossing the border to do business in Shenzhen, which a lot of Hong Kongers do, the police are now in some cases asking to see their phones, their social media accounts, their pictures. Some people have been made to sign these letters committing that they won't participate in protests. I know other Hong Kong friends who do have to go to China, mainland China for work. They take another phone. Others are too scared to go. So I think it's more the effect that way, that Hong Kongers who have to do business in the mainland are much more concerned. I think in China as a whole, we've seen very little support for the democracy movement in Hong Kong. In fact, sentiment has really turned strongly against it. And I think that's partly down to the censorship initially, and now a big propaganda push to paint Hong Kong protesters as terrorists who are the tools of US black hands. But I think there's genuinely just a lot of misunderstanding about Hong Kong. It's not just propaganda. We know we can have deep polarization even in democracies like the US or the UK. So I think a lot of mainland people just don't understand Hong Kong values and the Hong Kong identity. And that's, yeah, it's pretty tragic. But for that reason, yeah, it's been much less of a direct threat to Chinese rule in a way than, say, the Tiananmen protests, which did spread across China.
So the woman down here.
Thanks. I'm just another Hong Konger who lives in Australia. My question to the panel is, if I remember correctly, Martin Lee, who was part of the Basic Law Drafting Committee, has anecdotally said on many occasions that one country, two systems had the intent of maintaining Hong Kong's values, freedoms, way of life for 50 years so that China can catch up democratically. Now, of course, we know, well, whether that is true or not, we don't know. What do you think are the underlying reasons for China to push for gaining full control of Hong Kong before the 50 years, before 2047? What are the motivations behind it? Because I think, wouldn't that like answer a lot of the questions as to why they're progressing and doing things the way they are?
Dr. Chan?
That's a very good question. I have been asking myself why for some time, actually. So I actually think is if you're thinking about the Chinese leaders in the few generations, particularly in the last few generations, Xi Jinping's foreign policies, domestic policy, completely or not completely, but quite different with the previous leader, is more assertive. And he really want to control, internally as well as hopefully to expand China's power or get the being a great power. On the other hand, so what is the intention here? Is like because you're seeing they don't really go back to like they don't really want to have the second war is within their territories. So within their territories, everything should be listened to the central government. So it doesn't matter what the Hong Kong people want. What the central government want is more important because they want to maintain their stability in the society. And so I think it probably bring that, one of the reasons that probably pushed the Hong Kong government to be more closer to the central government's policy, align with the central government's policy. But on the other hand, I also think the Hong Kong's leadership right now, they are also trying to giving up the autonomy of Hong Kong as well. It's not the overall population. Overall population, we still want to maintain this two system. But the leadership position, they really want to, guarantee what they, their political life. Even though right now you're talking about after they become they step down as the chief executive, what would happen to Dong Zhihua or the last chief executive? They become the vice chairman of the consultation, the political consultation conference in China. So that is their political life. And so if they want to keep them, maintain their political life, have some influence, then they will just try to align with the central government's, the policy. So that's a both side thing. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right at the very back, the woman.
Thank you. Thank you for the panel. My name is Phoebe Alexander. I'm an ex-journalist. I'm very interested to get the view of your views of one country, two system. Did you really believe, fundamentally it will work? And also in 2045, Hong Kong will be reverting to China completely. What's wrong with what China's doing now? They're just slowly inserting their authority. What's the matter with that?
Well, who wants to what? You have a go first, Jared, then Ben? Yeah. What's wrong with what China's doing?
Well, it's important to point out that since 2014, when there was a much more stern voice on demanding universal suffrage, this universal suffrage was also a part of the agreement in the Basic Law. But it hasn't been fulfilled. It's been 21 years. So even if Hong Kong by 2047 was to completely become just another Chinese city, these remaining 29 years or so, we should still have what we were promised, which is actual universal suffrage.
Plus a high degree of autonomy.
Plus a high degree of autonomy.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Okay. Ben?
I actually think, the Hong Kong system was designed to fail, and it's totally contradictory. So it's true that there was this promise of universal suffrage, but also with the candidates selected by an appropriate nominating committee. So you can imagine there are many different versions of appropriate, but there are many things in the Basic Law which also give power to China to unilaterally send in the People's Liberation Army, to unilaterally change Hong Kong's law, to force the chief executive to carry out any directive given by the Central People's Government, to bring in Chinese-style sedition laws against defaming the Communist Party, which Hong Kong still hasn't done. So I think it was a fundamentally contradictory document. It was a necessary compromise at the time, but I think it was always going to be impossible for this to fail. And I think there was too much sort of rosy thinking. Understandably, from the people who drew this up, they wanted to imagine a better world. And the last thing I just say on that is that the likes of Martin Lee and Chan Kin-man, who's now in jail, one of the umbrella leaders, they did believe in bringing China up, that this was a movement for democracy in the whole of China. And that's now really shifted. The young people who are on the front lines, as Laiha was saying, don't care about that anymore. But I think it was somewhat, you know, optimistic to believe that China could be opened up in that way. And I think that's a realization, you know, not just in Hong Kong, but many governments and people all around the world are now taking on.
So I'm not repeating what their argument or the points, which I agree with there, whether or not it works. And I want to, you know, make some comments about how to make it work. So in order for the one country, two system to make it work, I think the Hong Kong right now, the protest, the citizens right now, they're trying to keep this kind of the promise, the two systems promise. And certainly there's lots of, the uphill battles, and I don't think they will be, I'm not very optimistic about they will success through this protest. But what can we do or how to make it work? I think it's not only just Hong Kong's population, but the international society, Australia and other countries, the Western democracy. At the end of the day, what they're asking for is trying to uphold this liberal Ryu, the autonomy, the independent legal system. I repeat, like earlier I mentioned about that. This kind of the value is very exactly the same. Australia, US and UK, all this democracy we are upholding. So why not we can, you know, trying to bring that, that two system work based on that kind of the values. I take an example. US and Hong Kong, they have a policy act in 1992. So that kind of the policy act basically provide Hong Kong with as a special status in terms of doing trade, the people movement, the visa, etc. And so far, I haven't seen Australian doing that kind of the special policy with Hong Kong. We can maybe, hopefully, Australian can do that because Australian also, we also, you know, upholding this kind of the liberal values as well. And other countries can do the same thing. So that is the thing. I actually think the international society, how we can bring China to go back to the two system, that formula, not just looking at the one, you know, from Beijing's perspective, they're looking at the one country, very, very big. But from outside, can we bring the two system in front of their eyes? One of the thing is like if a country really want to be a responsible, you know, great powers, they have to understand where's the legitimacy come from. So what kind of legitimacy? And the legitimacy is not from inside, it's from the outside, the people. Do any other, you know, the international society, how many countries they are happy to say, oh, okay, this is the great power. So if you want to be great, responsible great power, you have to, get the legitimacy. And in order to get the legitimacy, you need to go back to the rule of law.
Gentlemen there.
Thank you. Tom Wilkins from University of Sydney. Looking back into Hong Kong's history, are there any parallels or lessons that can be learned from the 1966 Star Ferry riots or the 1967 leftist riots, for example?
People have been writing about this in recent days. Ben, do you want to take that on?
I think it's an interesting case when Hong Kong was also sort of on the brink of chaos. In fact, the violence then from sort of Cultural Revolution inspired violence was much worse. There were actual bombs going off, whereas now it's been smoke bombs, thankfully. But I think the environment has just completely changed. Then the colonial power was Britain. And obviously the good side of that was the discord did spark the British to go on this spree of economic development, building better housing, which created the modern Hong Kong we see today in some respects. But I think the situation now is completely different. I think the economic the argument this is all about economics is overdone. I don't think now you can rewrite history and suddenly say to Jared and his friends fighting for Hong Kong identity, oh, don't worry, mate, we'll build you a nice cheap house. You know, that ship has sailed long ago. So maybe if Hong Kong economy had been fairer 20 years ago and the tycoons hadn't been controlling it, etc., things could have been done differently. I think it's too late for those sorts of solutions.
I just want to interject a bit about how bad the living standards of Hong Kong currently is, because there's such a huge disparity between the rich and the poor in Hong Kong. And literally, there are huge amounts of populations living in what we would call coffin apartments, where their house, or I would say their room, is just a room. And your toilet doesn't even have a separate divider. And to put in perspective, people who are living in such conditions and even other people who pay up to half or two-thirds of their income just to sustain that kind of environment, they have nothing to lose. So why not try to achieve democracy where they could have actual political influence to change this economic system? Because obviously, under Hong Kong's current system, half of the legislators are elected directly, the other half are from different constituencies, and obviously these constituencies are closely related with businesses, tycoons, and with the Hong Kong government. But they, when they get into office, they wield the exact same power as the democratically elected ones, and that's why there is no permanent or effective change in people's livelihoods. And living standards are continually to decrease. So that's why people are trying to now have a system where they could at least experiment to attempt a kind of change.
Okay, we might note that in 1967, which is the Cultural Revolution riots in Hong Kong, that was by underground members of the Communist Party, and the Chinese Communist Party, we might note, ironically, is still not a legal organization in Hong Kong. Now, last question. I'm sorry, a lot of questions, I'm sorry, but last question up the front there, we're hitting the time.
Russell Thomas, Sydney University. My question's about, assuming, Professor Chan, that you're right and that the PLA won't intervene in Hong Kong, what's your view on the likely course of action that the government, the Chinese government, could take? So we've seen the role of economic pressure placed on Taiwan in the last couple of decades. What sort of measures could be taken, and are they likely to be taken, especially in terms of the enormous push for the Pearl River Delta Greater Bay Area Initiative? Thanks.
Thank you for the question. So I actually think the central government already taking some measure to, you know, as I say, putting more pressure to the leaders in Hong Kong, and as well as to the police as well. So this is currently they really want to stop it, the protest. But if once the protest pass, I think they have like the misunderstanding from the central government as they're talking about, you know, whether this is the economic factor. So from the central government, the Beijing thing, that's purely maybe because this is the economic factor. And so they will hopefully, if the protest pass peacefully, they might try to bring the, you know, a little bit, give a little bit of more sweet, economic sweet to Hong Kong, and hopefully the citizens still vote for the pro-Beijing politician in the next election. So the next election will start, next year in 2020. But in the current situation, I think the protester will ally together and trying to block the pro-Beijing's candidates in the next election. So once the things will, you know, if assuming the things pass in the coming few months or a couple months, then I think they will try to, you know, hopefully will provide the economic incentive and give the pro-Beijing candidate hopefully the citizen will like them a little bit more.
Thank you. I think we're already run over time. So on that note, we've got to finish. I would like to thank our panellists. I particularly want to thank Jared, who's shown a lot of guts coming up here tonight. So I'm feeling paternal pride in him, as he's only 20 years old, so I wish I was that articulate when I was 20 years old.
This is a new generation.
Yeah, so thanks very much.